Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here on Monday, October 29th, 2018. I'm going to be joined later on in the show by Fangraphs' Meg Rowley and ESPN's Mike Sando here in a moment. But first, I wanted to talk about the Cleveland Browns, a team that, well, I'm not going to lie, we recorded part of the show this morning with Mike Sando. We talked about the Cleveland Browns and their decision to fire Hugh Jackson. We talked about it in the context of Todd Haley and thought, well, he is a likely candidate to be either promoted to head coach or have a meaningful say in the head coach in the months to come. Well, Todd Haley was also fired shortly after we recorded that. So I'm not going to play that for you here as we start the show. I am going to talk about the Browns, though, because I think they're in a really fascinating sort of situation in that on paper, this is an organization that has a lot for any head coach to look for. They have a young quarterback in Baker Mayfield who has been inconsistent to start his career, but certainly showed promise coming out of Oklahoma, a former first overall pick. You would think he is a desirable asset for a head coach who wants to work with a young quarterback, given how he played at Oklahoma. They have a team that is full of young draft picks, given how many draft picks that Sashi Brown was able to amass. They have a general manager who has been very effective. John Dorsey had a lot of success in Kansas City. All those things would conspire to say, hey, this might be a place I might want to go coach if I am a Lincoln Riley, for example, if I am a promising young head coach. The reason why the Browns job is not appealing and why I don't think any coach of any renown is going to end up taking this job come 2019 is the fact that the owner of this team is Jimmy Haslam. And this is an ownership group that has been an absolute disaster for, I believe, almost a decade now in terms of the coaches they've hired, in terms of the coaches they've fired, in terms of the decisions they've made, in terms of the timing of the decisions they made. This is an organization that that went out and fired Sashi Brown after 2 years, which I don't think is an unreasonable decision given how they played, but that decided to keep Hugh Jackson around. And when they hired John Dorsey in December of 2017, Jimmy Haslam, according to published reports, told John Dorsey that Hugh Jackson would remain as the head coach and that there was no debate. The exact quote that was reported was, "I don't think Hugh Jackson has lost his magic," which implies that there is Hugh Jackson magic just lying around somewhere in Cleveland like radioactive waste at the moment, because it has not been located in the Brown Stadium anytime recently. So if you are a Lincoln Riley, if you are someone who is a smart head coach who is going to have options to coach in the NFL if and when you want to come work in the NFL as a head coach, why would you want to work with a head coach who fired his GM 2 years into a massive rebuild after assuredly saying you have more time than 2 years, who responded to a power struggle between the head coach and offensive coordinator by firing both of them in midseason? They have promoted Greg Williams. I don't know that Greg Williams is a long-term solution. Certainly the Browns pass rush, the Browns defense has been better than a lot of people expected. They were second in the league in DVOA heading into the week. They're going to drop given how the Steelers played against them on Sunday, but this is a defense that has been actually pretty good. Now, Greg Williams, of course, we know his track record. This is a coach who, was suspended for a year under the Bountygate scandal. He was 17-31 as a head coach with the Bills. I believe that was 15 years ago. At this point, that was, I believe, the last days of Doug Flutie. No, sorry, it was Alex Van Pelt and Rob Johnson in Buffalo starting his tenure there. This is a guy who has, of course, won a Super Bowl with the New Orleans Saints before the Bountygate scandal. But you get the idea. This is a coach who would not be considered for a head coaching gig just about anywhere else in the NFL, who is now the interim head coach of the Cleveland Browns. My suggestion here, not that the Browns are listening to me by any means, play out the rest of the season. Do whatever you can to convince smart head coaches that you are building a stable organization. If you are emulating the 49ers, for example, an organization that looks to be in much better shape, even given the Jimmy Garoppolo injury than it was several years ago, they had to hand out lengthy contracts to John Lynch and Kyle Shanahan. I believe they were 6 years, if I'm not mistaken. They were six-year deals for both the general manager and the head coach. That's almost unprecedented to my knowledge in the NFL. So the Browns may have to do that to attract a really good head coach, but they can't just stick with an interim coach. They can't stick with Greg Williams just because he is a familiar face who's not going to cost a ton of money and who's willing to take this job. They have to aim higher come this offseason. So for the Browns, spend the rest of the year keeping Baker Mayfield healthy, work on the defense, keep it at a high level, convince Greg Williams to stick around as defensive coordinator. He's been just fine in that job, but the idea of sticking with him as an interim coach is hazardous to this team's future, I think it's fair to say. And I fear that until we get to a point where the ownership either changes or does not get involved in decision making to the extent that it has over the last decade, I fear that the Browns, no matter who they get as quarterback, no matter how much talent, no matter how many draft picks they amass, this is not going to be a job that seriously talented coaches are ever going to consider. Now, one coach who may end up actually being in for a discussion with the Cleveland Browns after the year is Mike McCarthy. Of course, if Mike McCarthy were to struggle in Green Bay, there's a chance that he could possibly meet up with John Dorsey again after the season, move to Cleveland, coach a young quarterback in Baker Mayfield. That's hardly out of the question. And someone who was watching Mike McCarthy work yesterday in the Green Bay Los Angeles game was our guest, Mike Sando.
And I have to admit, I do feel a little cheated that we did not get to see Aaron Rodgers get a drive to win that game in the fourth quarter against the still undefeated Los Angeles Rams.
Oh, me too. I mean, not only that, it was going to be one timeout and a play on the other side of the 2 minute warning. It was going to be 2:05. So, I mean, that's easy. That, you know, especially you're not talking like you have to absolutely have a touchdown. That's just Aaron Rodgers is probably going to win the game. Mm-hmm. Aaron Rodgers is going to go down the field. And it's not going to be quite as easy as it was against the 49ers. But remember in that game, he threw an incomplete pass just to use a few seconds, just so they could. Yes. I mean, that's how scared you are defensively when one of these great quarterbacks is in that situation. I mean, mm-hmm. he can just play you down the field. So I felt cheated, too. I mean, it was great for the Rams, a great Rams win. I mean, mm-hmm. it was really cool to be there, even though there was tons of Packers fans. The stadium was rocking. They were playing. You know, I love L.A. It just mm-hmm. felt like a great win for the Rams, for L.A. I think they were a little nervous, you know, not the team and the players, but just other people in the organization were looking mm-hmm. at this like, hey, it's a national TV game. Everyone's going to be watching us against the Packers. Let's have a good performance. So they got their win, but I'm with you. I would have loved, just as a fan of football, to see Rodgers get the ball. Shocked that Montgomery ends up bringing the ball out. I mean, what is going yeah. on? That was just terrible.
Yeah, it just didn't make a lot of sense given the situation. I think you don't want to do anything that's going to take the ball out of Aaron Rodgers' hands. And not to say Tom Montgomery isn't a good player, that he's not capable of returning a kickoff without fumbling. Obviously he is, but just in that moment, I think the situation called for him to just hold on to the football, not take it out, and then just give Aaron Rodgers a chance to do what Aaron Rodgers is going to do. And I mean, in this game, it wasn't like Rodgers was, you know, incredible for the entire contest. The numbers were, in the long run, were good. 18 of 30 for 286, one touchdown. And you know, they were close, obviously. They were within 2 points by the end of the game when the Rams kicked a field goal to go up 29-27. But honestly, this was a game that was more about the defense for the first half of this contest on both sides. Was that something that surprised you, or do you think that this was maybe more of a, you know, a better matchup for these defenses than we might have thought?
No, it did surprise me. You know, it was funny. By the end of the game, it's 29-27, and I think we were thinking it was a 30-30 game. So it ended up being, you know, who we thought they were, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it ended up being that kind of game. But I was surprised early, and I thought, you know, after the game, I was talking to a couple coaches around the league who got a chance to watch the game, and they thought, you know, there were some zone and man pressures that Green Bay used in the game that maybe others could use in the future. You know, and I think – for as great as the Rams have been in putting together this offense, there's still a way to beat them, you know. Mm-hmm. And we saw it in the playoffs with Atlanta last year, and they're still not the team. I don't feel as comfortable with them if they had to play from behind. You know, mm-hmm. I think they have it when they get it set up their way. Good luck. I mean, they're really hard to beat, but I don't think they're this unbeatable foe, and we've seen that from, you know, Seattle played them within a couple points before Seattle was really clicking, and now Green Bay on the road did have the bye week, played them really tough. So yeah, the nature of the game really surprised me. I think there's some things opponents can see and try to replicate, but in the end, 29-27 is probably close to what we thought it would be.
Yeah, I think the total for the game in Vegas beforehand was 56.5, and it got to 56 and would have gone over 56 if Todd Gurley had answered the prayers of fantasy owners and of Vegas overbetters by going in for a touchdown instead of kneeling inside the 10-yard line at the end of that game. I mean, you know, I think there's not like, there's not some grand secret, I guess, to beating the Rams. There's not something you have to do that's never been recorded in the history of football before. But I think what we saw early in this game was that the Packers really dominated the line of scrimmage up front. They really, you know, shut down Todd Gurley. They were getting pressure on Jared Goff. They were showing looks that maybe Jared Goff had not seen before on tape and was not expecting, and he struggled to sort of react to those. But this is a team that when they're healthy, especially after adding those pieces to the secondary, they have guys who can cover. They have young players who have the speed to cover, and they have a front seven that's experienced, that has a lot of talent, and that can win up front. And if you can do that, if you can win up front against the Rams or any other offense in the league, yep, you're gonna execute and you're gonna stop them. That's just the nature of how football has been for 60 years.
Yep. So I'm anxious to see. Does this mean now that with some of those younger players, the Packers can kind of grow as the season goes on, and by mm-hmm. the end of the year, be a more formidable team? From the Rams standpoint, sitting in the game and being in the, you know, in the press box, and it was really cool. It was like open air. Mm-hmm. You could really feel the crowd, and I was kind of craning my head around. I kept watching the play clock. You know, that whole thing about Sean McVay before the cutoff, mm-hmm. is he changing plays? You know, some people might say that's been overblown, mm-hmm. but I think it's a real thing, and I was sort of watching to see, like, okay, are the Packers doing late disguises? Are they doing stuff after that cutoff? And there were times when the crowd was really loud for Packers. I mean, there was a huge, you know, it's a game in L.A. It's sort of a soft target for visiting people coming in, big sure. stadium. The World Series is going on the same day. I mean, it felt like if there were, I don't know, 75,000 people there, it felt like 45,000 of them were Packer fans. It was mm-hmm. really amazing, and what I'm getting at is there was noise. They were going to, you could see the right guard turning around and shaking his fist at Goff. How does that all play if they're in the road playing the Saints this mm-hmm. week, or, you know, some hostile environments? They're probably going to have home field advantage, so it may not bother them, but I was watching that with them in this game. It's sort of a fascinating part of their team to me. It's just, how much is McVay orchestrating? Is that overrated? I think they're interesting.
Yeah, and I think it'd be interesting to see what happens when they play the Eagles at home in Week 15 in December, a game that you would figure would also have a ton of possible road fans coming into that stadium, or if they play one of those teams, if they play the Eagles, if they play the Saints, if they play the Packers again in the postseason in Los Angeles, if that home field advantage is really as strong as you might think when we get to January. It's a really fascinating idea, and I think there is a... You know, I think I see both sides of it, maybe. You know, I do think it's probably a little overstated that Sean McVay is sort of, you know, Jared Goff would be useless if Sean McVay wasn't steering him towards, you know, open right. receivers before the snap. But there was some truth to it at the same time. Obviously, you know, McVay is making Jared Goff's life easier, and Jared Goff is executing a lot of the passes. I mean, saw in this game as it went on, Jared Goff was not great at first and has not been great really since that Vikings game we saw, where he was incredible on national television on Thursday night, but he did enough to win this game. And I think, you know, maybe if they don't get that fake punt from Johnny Hecker, maybe the Packers score again on that drive in the first half, and that changes things. Or it's hard to say, and I don't know that the team is going to go 16-0, but I do think this is still, you know, maybe quite comfortably the best team in the NFL.
Yeah, I think they're really good. Now, the next 2 weeks, they've got the Saints and the Seahawks. Mm-hmm. So those are tough games. And it seems like a lot of these teams, if you look at the Packers' upcoming schedule, the Saints and Vikings just played, it seems like there's a lot of great games here over the next month that are going to help us make better sense of this. I think the Rams are going to, they're going to lose a couple games here or there, and I'm not going to panic. I mean, that's just the course of the season. I'm surprised to see them favored at New Orleans. I mean, mm-hmm. That's a lot of respect. I mean, that's an acknowledgement of how good they are. But I feel like in analysis, we get ahead of ourselves sometimes.
Sure.
Not you and me, of course.
No, we're
correct. But in general, we get excited. I mean, it's a week-to-week Twitter world, right? And
for
this
sure.
guy's the greatest ever, and this is amazing. And, you know, they didn't win a playoff game last year.
Yeah.
I think there are hurdles for this team to still clear, and they got over one yesterday. And I think they're going to be probably have the home field in the NFC, but I'm not anointing yet for it, saying that they're going to be in the Super Bowl yet. I need to see more before I feel like they're going to go through the gauntlet in the playoffs where I think you do get into situations where your quarterback's got to win in 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the next step for them.
Yeah, I think that's a very viable sort of thing for them to do. And I think they can do that, but I do want to see it actually happen.
Yep.
You know, I do want to see what happens when this team is under some level of adversity. They've been very healthy this year. They have been leading in most of their games. So absolutely, I think that's sort of the next step for them. We should talk about some trades, though. You have a column going up for ESPN Plus today talking about some viable trades that you've discussed with executives and coaches around the league. And we should run through some of those, some of the fits. I think that makes interest me. I know I wrote a column on it, and I think your trades are a lot better than my trades. I want to go through those. All right, Mike, let's get to some possible NFL trades here in a moment. But first, I wanted to talk about our pals at ZipRecruiter. Now, of course, there are a lot of teams who are looking to add a key player to their roster over the next couple days as the trade deadline approaches in the NFL. A lot of teams that have open spaces in their roster want to add a key contributor at a key position. Well, I wish some of them would use ZipRecruiter, because I don't know how many NFL players are actually on ZipRecruiter, but given that it works this well for every other industry, I can't imagine it wouldn't work for the NFL as well, because it's not about you having to go out, send your scouts out to try and find someone to fill your job. It is exactly the opposite on ZipRecruiter. If you post your job on ZipRecruiter, people come to you, and not just people who are useless, qualified people come to you, the best kind of people for the job you are looking to fill, because ZipRecruiter actively invites them to apply. Their powerful matching technology scans resumes, identifies people with the right skills and the right experience for your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. It is ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. My last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now back to the show. Someone who we both discussed in each of our columns, but had going to different teams, and it seems like at the same time there's reports that the Bills are not necessarily interested in trading him, is LeSean McCoy, who I thought might have been a good fit for the Eagles, but you're saying actually you think he is a better fit for the team we saw yesterday, the Green Bay Packers.
Well, I'll let you into my process here. So I talked to a lot of people over the last week, and I was mm-hmm. pretty happy with my list, but there's a couple teams that I just couldn't find the right guy for. And so I'm talking to one of my good contacts last night in mm-hmm. the Rams press box. I'm like, can you help me out on Green Bay? I mean, what should I get for Green Bay? I'm just not, you know, they've spent so much on corners. I'm not going to mm-hmm. have Janoris Jenkins go in there. You know, what do we do? And he's like, duh, did you just watch the game? Golf, did they have a dynamic running back for once? You know, and he just went off, and there was like four expletives in there. I couldn't use all of his comments, but he sold me on it. I was like, yeah, you're right. I mean, they just sort of make do with the position. You're happy mm-hmm. they have a couple young guys, but, you know, they get nailed for a safety in this game. Not that LeSean McCoy would have gone for 100 yards, but he mm-hmm. changes the way people play you a little bit. And I mm-hmm. think in this game yesterday, you can't, you know, we can talk about running backs not being valued as much and how it's a passing league. Well, I'm telling you, the way you have to account for Todd Gurley affects everything for the Rams. And there's no one, and hasn't been anyone, for the Packers, and part of that's because Aaron Rodgers doesn't need it as much. But can mm-hmm. you imagine if you had a dynamic force for him to, for people to at least have to consider giving the ball to? Mm-hmm. I think it would transform their team. So what would it take on LeSean McCoy? And I had a couple, you know, hardcore Bills fans were like, you're giving him a safe, strong safety, Josh Jones, for and a conditional pick, and mm-hmm. we can quibble with that. I don't know what the compensation is. I mean, maybe it's a draft pick. Maybe they wouldn't want Josh Jones, who seems to not be playing nearly as much mm-hmm. under Mike Pettine. But to me, the overall concept was Green Bay, Buffalo's seventh oldest roster in the league when you mm-hmm. count all their reserve lists, needing to get younger. McCoy probably not there 2 years from now. Why not at least consider it? And from a Packers standpoint, you're totally different with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously Aaron Jones has been effective as a runner in this offense, but that doesn't preclude you from using Aaron Jones in this offense. It gives you time to let him develop as a pass blocker, and it also lets you, you know, have him fresh for when you want him for 7 or 8 carries a game, and have Shady, you know, in that secondary role where he takes 10, 12 carries a game, hopefully, and then is a threat as a receiver as well. So absolutely, I think it makes total sense. And, you know, again, like the, are the Bills looking for a, you know, a strong safety? Maybe not, but this is a team that I don't think they really have a lot of positions where they can say, okay, we're sure we are set at this position for the next 5 years. I mean, the Bills have free agents playing at safety right now, and they're good players, but I think they need young talent in just about any possible position. So it makes sense to me. Someone who I talked about last year, and I figured it made perfect sense. We talked about Todd Haley earlier, was Larry Fitzgerald. I thought, okay, the Cardinals are going nowhere. Carson Palmer is done for the year. Let's get Larry Fitzgerald to the Steelers. They could use another wide receiver to replace Martavis Bryant at the time. He knows the scheme. Perfect fit. Did not happen. Did not come close to happening. You have Larry Fitzgerald now going somewhere else.
Yeah, I'd send him to New England. And I know they've got Josh Gordon going. They've got Rob Gronkowski. But, you know, Larry Fitzgerald is now a slot receiver, and my thinking was, hey, if he's about done, let's just say he's moved up the list enough for his career, he's going to retire after this year. Don't know, you know, he probably hasn't decided, but if he were, why not, you know, give the Cardinals kind of the green light and go try to finish your career with Tom Brady? Fitzgerald, people forget, and maybe they don't forget, but I mean, he gave the Cardinals the lead in the final 2 minutes of a Super Bowl before. I mean, he was a great playoff performer. I think he's exactly the type of guy a playoff team could use. And, you know, Pittsburgh was obviously a playoff-type team. But put him with Tom Brady, put him with Josh McDaniels, put him in that offense. Sounds like a lot of fun to me.
Yeah, I mean, 400-yard games for him during that postseason, 127 yards and 2 touchdowns, total of 7 touchdowns during that postseason in 2008. Just one of the most incredible postseasons you'll ever see from a wide receiver, and had 176 yards against the Packers as recently as the 2015 playoffs, so January of 2016 in that famous Rodgers double Hail Mary game. So, I mean, this is a guy who, you know, has been able to elevate his game in the postseason and still has something in the tank, had 102 yards and a touchdown yesterday against the Niners. So you figure, okay, his numbers have been down, but, I mean, this offense has not been very good in general. You'd figure he still has something left for a better offense to work with the Patriots.
Oh, yeah, and he's had down spells before. You know, they played with Max Hall and John Skelton and, you know, really replacement-level quarterbacks. And so, you know, we probably think better of Josh Rosen than that, but obviously there's major issues. They've changed their coordinator. They don't have a good line. Their line was bad before they lost guys like A.Q. Shipley. You know, David Johnson seems to have struggled to transition in the new offense. They don't have the great speed. You know, their tight end situation's not great. So there's all kinds of evidence that Larry Fitzgerald, with the right offense, you know, with even an average one, is a good player.
You also have another key Cardinals player leaving the team via possible trade as well.
Yeah, the next time I walk past Steve Keim, I'm going to kind of look away because, like, what are you doing? You're dismantling my roster, what we've got left. But I actually had three total on them? I had Patrick Peterson going to Minnesota, which was just sort of a reprise of a column I wrote last week. I think the interesting thing between those two teams, Arizona and Minnesota, is that Minnesota has a third-round comp pick in 2019 riding on whether Sam Bradford is on the Cardinals roster in Week 10. It's complicated. I mean, we can go through the formula, but just know that. That's an interesting thing. Whether or not there's any trade involving Peterson, which is obviously a big long shot at this time. The thinking there was, though, Mike Zimmer defense, Xavier Rhodes, Pat Peterson together, that is bliss. If from Arizona's standpoint, it was mostly coming from Peterson had asked for a trade. And then are you building for the future? What are you building? Can you get a haul of picks? I think I had Trey Waynes, who may or may not be in the Vikings' plans, coming over as some corner insurance. The idea would be building your offense. What do you got to do to build that offense? So that was one. I had another one for them with Hassan Reddick.
Yes.
Again, I don't know what they're going to do with him. I think it's premature to probably trade him. But 13th overall pick in a James Betcher defense, wasn't really playing for a few weeks early this year. Now he is playing. But what's his best role? What scheme fits him well? what could you get for him? I think it's just an interesting thing to think through.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think there's that discussion for him, possibly for Deion Buchanan, who's going to be a free agent after this season. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts there in Arizona who could be up for discussion. A trade I really liked, a guy who I wasn't thinking about, but when you mentioned him, made total sense to me, was Joe Staley, who's still, I think, playing at a pretty high level for the 49ers. Maybe not the guy he used to be as he's in his mid-30s, but still a very functional offensive tackle at a position where I think there's a lot of teams around the league who would love to add a useful tackle right now. You have him going to a team that has really struggled with injuries up front this season.
Yep, I said, why not the Chargers, you know?
Yep.
And so they've obviously got Russell Okung. They can play him at left tackle. Joe Staley played right tackle early in his career. Mm-hmm. Just a great, solid veteran player, consistent. I think he could go over to that right tackle spot for a team in the Chargers that has a real chance. You know, they last year amazingly missed the playoffs despite being really good on offense and defense.
Yes.
That's hard to do. They had to be historically bad on special teams. It seems like there's always something that holds them back. And it doesn't seem like they, you know, I don't know if it's their, you know, their ownership or what. They don't seem to make moves like this, but
right.
I would support it for them. I think it's a good idea for them. Have gotten good feedback on this one, too. I actually got a couple texts from other people that were similar along your lines of thinking. And really, I thought of this one just going through the rosters of the mm-hmm. bad teams and who could be on the table, you know, and you actually come up with a pretty long list of names, and why not Staley? They drafted McGlinchey, right? So
yep.
Play him there.
Yeah, I think in the long term, they want McGlinchey to be their starting left tackle. This is a team that I think it's fair to say they're not going very far this year without Jimmy Garoppolo. Why not give McGlinchey those reps right now? Let him develop as a left tackle. So hopefully when you get Garoppolo back, McGlinchey is ready to play on the left side, or you know, or have a better idea that maybe he's not fit out to be a left tackle at the NFL level, and you can go out and get a left tackle this offseason. We'll stay in the Bay. We'll finish up there. There's a lot more trades in the column in ESPN Plus, but let's talk about the Raiders. Of course, a team that has already traded Amari Cooper for a first-round pick. They've traded Khalil Mack for two first-round picks. A lot of players in the discussions there about possible trades, Derek Carr being perhaps the most prominent. You don't have Carr being traded. Are there other players you think are likely or would make sense to move on from Oakland here before the trade deadline on Tuesday?
Well, they definitely shopped Carl Joseph, but
yes.
From what I've heard, are asking for a little too much.
Mm-hmm.
And one theme, one thread through the Raider moves is they're not unloading guys for nothing. You know,
yes.
Amari Cooper's for a first-round pick. Khalil Mack's for a couple of firsts. So
mm-hmm.
It almost gives some credence to, you know, when John Gruden says, look, we're not shopping them, but they are for only if the price is great. So my question is there anyone left on the roster besides Carr who mm-hmm. would get a lot in return? I think Carr for this year, I think you end up taking big proration hits, and I think they need him for this season. That would be probably going too far.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about the Raiders to me is why are you adding a bunch of number one picks? Because if you use them just like people use number one picks, then you're hoping to get Khalil Mack and Amari Cooper's, basically, right? You're looking mm-hmm. to get what you already had. To me, the reason why you're adding number one picks is so you have max flexibility to get a quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
And wait a minute, you already have one.
Right.
So I think there's very much uncertainty of Derek Carr after the season. What direction is John Gruden going to go? And maybe they give Carr next year, too.
Yeah.
I don't know, but there's a lot going on there. I don't think that's a marriage. I think there's a prenup in that marriage between Gruden and Carr. And so stay loose. I just didn't have him moving this year.
Yeah, I mean, one of those guys, it would cost the Raiders, I think, $7.5 million in dead money to move on from. Another one, it would cost presumably $90 million to move on from. So you can figure that the guy who's owed $90 million over the next 9 years has a lot more saying what happens at quarterback than the guy who's owed $7.5 million or would be responsible for $7.5 million in accounting charges if they...
Yes. Now, the cap hit, I'm just going to over the cap. It looks like there's a big hit on Carr for this year. There'd be $32 million in proration for them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's maybe a lower number this late in the year, but that's sort of why I
right.
felt like, hey, this is an after-the-season move for them.
For sure. And he played well yesterday. It wasn't like he's been struggling. He had his best game of the season yesterday against the Colts in a game where they didn't win, but he was not the problem in that contest. Garyon Conley's also come up in the secondary, a cornerback, former first-round pick, who has not been playing very much. But you have there an edge rusher leaving the Raiders for a team that we talked about earlier who makes perfect sense in terms of needing some veteran help on the outside.
Yeah, Bruce Irvin, a little bit older. I think he's a good player. I think he's the type of guy you want on your team. But if John Gruden, you know, is adding picks at this point, and it's a little bit of a lost season, you're not going to be on, you know, good on defense, and you're not going to, you know, probably extend Irvin. Maybe look for something there. And I thought the Rams would be a perfect team. You know, I don't think they really need to do anything right now. They're 8-0. I mean, you think they're perfect, but as I look at them, what could raise its head in the postseason? I think that's where you really want to have that pass rush rotation primed. You know, we've seen where the Eagles had it last year when Seattle had that. You know, they were a Super Bowl team a couple of years. I think your defensive rotation lets you close out games. And so if we're just a little bit nervous right now, we're not 100% sure if Goff and that passing game are going to be able to bring you back late in the game. You know, let's finish off our opponents with an amazing pass rush. You know, you've got the Wade Phillips scheming. You've got, you know, good talent. You'll get to Aqib Talib back at some point in the secondary. Adding a Bruce Irvin type piece seems like it could give you some toughness and pass rush up front.
Yeah, absolutely. And no one's going to be trading, you know, a Khalil Mack level talent to the Rams at this point. I don't know if they have the cap space to even do that, although they've managed to pull it off in years past. But I think Bruce Irvin is a logical sort of veteran upgrade on the guys they have on the edge. He's going to supplement those guys as opposed to supplanting them. Well, Mike, you've got a lot more trades in your column on ESPN today, but where can people check out that and the rest of the stuff you do for us here at ESPN?
Yep, definitely. E Plus, we've got so much great stuff in the app, and then Sando ESPN on Twitter. I really appreciate it, Bill, and wouldn't trade this time for anything, and we'll get you next time.
I appreciate it, sir. Thank you so much. We'll come back here on the break talking baseball with Fangraph's Meg Rowley on the Bill Barnwell Show. All right, back here on the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. We are going to shift gears a tiny bit here. We talked about football quite frequently on the show. Of course, the World Series is now finished. Wanted to have a baseball guest on during the World Series. We missed it by a day. Was hoping for a Game 5 Dodgers victory. It did not happen, but there's still a lot to discuss about what happened in the World Series and what we're thinking about when it comes to baseball in the seasons to come and the conversations we were having during the World Series. And joining me to do that is a frequent contributor to this very show. It is Fangraph's Meg Rowley. Meg, how are you?
I'm good. I'm tired. this is always the weird... It's always so strange when the series ends because you're tired and you're ready for a break, but then you realize that you're going to not have baseball anymore. And once the fall league wraps up, you're really not going to have baseball for a while. So sort of a weird feeling.
I have to admit, I don't have this problem with football. Once we get to the Super Bowl, I'm just like, oh man, this is great. There's no football for like 6 months. Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, football is so concentrated, and yes. I have no trouble believing that it wears you out, I think, at maybe a higher rate, despite it being a shorter season, because the feelings are so intense in that short time that, you know, it wears you out.
Yes, football is like a very quick crush. Baseball is more of a long-running thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you think the right team won when you think about this Major League Baseball season in terms of the Boston Red Sox? Of course, they won a lot of games in the regular season and then proceeded to be dominant throughout the majority of the postseason.
Yeah, when we look at, they won a ton of games this year, the most in baseball. And then, you know, the World Series is such a strange thing because you take 162 games where we get a big sample and we can say things with, you know, maybe not certainty, but a high degree of confidence. And then we compress all of that into a month of baseball where we don't use pitchers the same way that we do during the regular season. And you have, you know, hitters squaring off against very good pitching. You know, you're not typically seeing like the worst reliever out of a bullpen pitch. So you take all of that, you know, big, beautiful sample that we love so much and you compress it into this thing that is baseball, but is sort of funky. But this was one of the rare years where, you know, we tended to see the right teams if we're thinking about overall talent level get into the playoffs and then advance in them. I mean, by our metrics at Fangraphs, you know, we have their actual record, but then we have Pythagorean records and base runs records. And the four best teams in baseball this year by base runs were the Astros, Dodgers, Red Sox, and Yankees. And there wasn't a tremendous amount of daylight between them in terms of wins, but we had the base runs record for the Red Sox, you know, a little bit below their actual record, but at 99 wins, the Astros were at 103. So you saw really good teams sort of fight each other in the playoffs, which didn't result in quite as entertaining a playoffs as we maybe expected going in, but they fought it out and one of the really good teams won. So I think that, you know, we don't always see the best teams in baseball winning the World Series. I mean, last year was an example of the Astros being a phenomenal team and they won. The Red Sox won this year. This was not the, you know, the 2015 Royals, for example. Like, this was a very good team that had some weaknesses, but those weaknesses didn't manifest themselves in quite the way we expected them to in the World Series, and they raised a trophy yesterday. So I think it kind of worked out the way it was supposed to.
Yes, it worked out in a way that allowed you to get a little bit of shade in at the 2015 Royals, which I'm assuming is not directly because she didn't work in baseball perspectives anymore, but sort of is that a knock at Danny Duffy's tweet about Pecota?
He did pick a kind of strange time to start going at the projection systems. Although I think he, you know, we can decide if he is right or wrong about how self-satisfied we can be when projections turn out the way that they're supposed to. I mean, we expected the Red Sox to be a good team going into the year, and it's nice to know that we get some things right on occasion. But no, it's not really a knock at the Royals. I like it when unexpected teams kind of perform better than they should, especially when, you know, they do so on the strength of, like, a really good bullpen like that 2015 Royals team did. But it can be nice to just see really good teams perform well in the postseason, especially if it gives players like, say, David Price an opportunity to redeem a kind of silly narrative about an inability to pitch well in the postseason, or to highlight guys who probably should not have led a team to a World Series win, like Steve Pierce. So I think there's always something fun to take from it, but it's nice to have a team that's this good kind of do what you expect them to.
Did you enjoy the quote from David Price after the World Series saying, "I hold all the cards now"? I mean, can you empathize with that in terms of where he's come from over the past few years?
I mean, I would like to, despite me making it a point in my work to often pretend I know what baseball players are feeling, I can't imagine how frustrating it must be for a player like him who, you know, Jared Price is a very good pitcher. And I think that, you know, a lot of people understand, at least when they have some distance from the teams involved, that the playoffs are a really strange time and that these are kind of fluky small samples. They're got, you know, that are sort of crude when guys are playing in a slightly different way than they do during the regular season, and that just because someone has not performed particularly well in the playoffs doesn't mean that they have sort of an innate inability to do so, right? There's no immutable characteristic about David Price that makes it hard for him to pitch in the postseason. But that doesn't stop us from, you know, hanging those ornaments on guys and having it sort of persist. I mean, the flip side of this is Clayton Kershaw, who, despite pitching a ton of postseason innings and pitching many of them very well, has yet to get this monkey off his back that he can't pitch in the postseason. So, I mean, if I were David Price, I think I would probably say something very similar to that. There is this really lovely little small moment when he came off the mound last night where, you know, he didn't turn to the camera, he didn't mug, he didn't, you know, turn to the fans to get a reaction from them, but you could just see as he was walking back to the dugout this smile creep across his face. Like, he knew, no matter what happened in that game, like, he had done all of the things he needed to do to show that he was capable of pitching the way we kind of expected him to be able to in the postseason. And, you know, he had that quiet moment, and then when he got in front of cameras, he got to have a louder one. I'm fine with that.
In terms of, you mentioned Clayton Kershaw. I'm not going to get into that argument about clutch or not clutch. Obviously, he is a great pitcher, but was a lot of criticism of Dave Roberts, his manager during this series, about how he handled his pitching staff, how he handled some of his decisions with regards to his lineups. I mean, overall, do you think he did a bad job relative to the options he had in front of him and how they performed?
I'm always nervous about criticism of managers because, I mean, there are things that are sort of objectively wrong in the moment. I mean, like, for example, Alex Cora was sort of saved from a very poor managerial decision when he kept Rodriguez in after, you know, it was clear that he was fatiguing, and then he gave up this big home run to Puig that didn't end up mattering. But I think that we would be well served to remember that managers have a lot more information about the current state of their roster than we do in any given moment. Sure. And that despite the fact that we put microphones in front of them every single day during the World Series, they aren't going to tell us everything that's going on with how a guy is feeling in any given moment, how fatigued he is. I will say that the pitching decisions last night did strike me as curious because, you know, and this is an obvious point, but the stakes are never higher than they are in an elimination game. And I can understand the mentality during the regular season of sort of living to fight another day. And maybe he didn't think that the options he had out of the pen were, you know, sort of superior to Kershaw in terms of guys having been fatigued over a very long weekend of baseball. But it did sort of feel like he was managing for, you know, a game that he wasn't necessarily going to get. You have to treat the elimination as present use only problem, and further fatigue down the road is future use issue, and you can't really worry about it. So I think that there were some kind of glaring decisions that were a little bit curious, and some, you know, maybe some lineup construction questions that we could raise. But I think we tend to overreact to those decisions in the moment and forget the many decisions that are the responsibility of other people that have preceded those and maybe necessitated hard choices. So did Roberts perfectly manage his pitching staff and his bullpen? No, he didn't. Was he given reinforcements at the trade deadline to help bolster that bullpen? I mean, not really. So, you know, we react to those moments because they're right in front of us and the stakes are so high and we'd like to see more baseball and we feel bad for Clayton Kershaw, but they are often the result of other choices that you're not necessarily making. And so it's not that he has no responsibility, but that the responsibility is perhaps more broadly shared.
And it seems like not only did he come in for criticism about his decisions, which is fine, and of course I think any losing World Series manager is going to come in for some criticism when things don't go the way they were hoping, but it was framed as sort of a, like, analytics versus feel argument, like Dave Roberts, because he was doing things in a progressive way, not dissimilar to, I think, the way a lot of other teams are managing their bullpens during this postseason, and maybe in some ways not even as aggressive as some other teams are managing their bullpens and their pitcher usage during this postseason. It felt like it was being framed as, oh, well, Dave Roberts is just listening to analytics and doesn't know what he's doing. And if he just listened to his gut, he would know how to handle the pitching staff. And it surprises me that we are having that conversation in 2018. I don't know if it surprises you, but do you think that's warranted? Like, do you think from an analytics perspective that he was mishandling things? Or do you think it's just people are looking for a sort of excuse to blame Roberts for making bad decisions, and then the fact that the Dodgers are well known as a analytically inclined organization led them to sort of have that debate?
I tend to think that it's a bit more of the latter. I mean, I always find that conversation strange because it assumes something about gut feel that I don't think we often see borne out. I mean, like, duh, obviously, but the gut feel thing is strange to me because it's like, well, okay, so let's say that he leaves Rich Hill in for longer, and it does seem like there was maybe some miscommunication between the two of them about how ready to come out Rich Hill felt he was versus how, you know, what he expected Roberts knew of his feelings in those moments. So there may have been some actual miscommunication there, but it's strange to me because are we to then assume that going by feel that Roberts is going to be able to reliably assess when that moment of wanting to pull your guy is before that guy gets into trouble, because that's the most obvious indicator of a player not being in a position to continue pitching, right? Is that, oh, wow, we were doing so great, and now Rich Hill's walked two guys and hit another batter, and the bases are loaded, and I guess now I go to my bullpen. And so I understand what people mean in that you have to take the information that that advanced metrics give you and then apply those within a particular setting and particular context. And sometimes that might mean, you know, letting a guy go a little longer than you would necessarily think based on third time through the order because, I don't know, he's being super efficient, his velocity's still up, whatever. But generally, those guidelines are useful, and in situations where the stakes are so high and your margin for error is so low, I don't think that relying on analytics to help guide that decision making and maybe remove some of the understandable emotion from the situation is necessarily a bad thing. Now, every pitcher is different, and we make a mistake. You know, Russell Carlton at Baseball Perspectives had this little nugget in a piece that he wrote that I think is so useful, which is that we talk about sample size and analytics all the time, but when you think about it, in some ways, the N actually equals one, right? You have to deal with the player in front of you, and sort of assess where they are. But I think that most smart teams look at analytics as a guideline, and it's clear that not every decision that the Dodgers made was necessarily being dictated by, you know, an equation somewhere. So I think that analytics in moments like this are sort of, it's sort of a convenient punching bag, and that word basically loses any meaning. Right. Like, what do we really mean by analytics in that moment? Analytics is such a broad category. So I don't know. I think that he made some managerial mistakes. I think that assuming that those are necessarily the result of an over-reliance on, like, a spreadsheet is a convenient narrative where the actual cause of those errors might be a little more nuanced, which is important for, you know, maybe not as important for us to understand as fans, although I'd like to think that we want to understand the game honestly, but is very important for them to understand internally at the Dodgers when they're assessing what to change going forward.
For sure. I do like the idea that Dave Roberts and Rich Hill had communication issues when I would say outside of maybe Chris Sale, Rich Hill is the least subtle pitcher in perhaps Major League Baseball history in terms of like the vulgarity, like the destroying of candies in the dugout.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine that if Rich Hill was upset or did not have a strong opinion on something that we would not know about it.
Yeah, it does seem like a very odd, rare time where he, you know, didn't express clearly how he was feeling in a moment. Rich, what do you have against snacks? It's not snacks' fault. Leave the snacks alone.
Just imagine if you were looking, and just a Dodgers player, just eyeing that, you know, you wanted those sweet tarts or something, and then just doesn't happen for you. Rich Hill just destroys it.
I wanted Laffy Taffy, and now there's none to be had.
It's very fair. In terms of that analytics debate, and specifically the third time through the order issue, because it did seem to come up a bunch with John Smoltz, who did not appear to be a very big fan of that argument. I guess the tough thing for me is, like, when I think about it, I can't say that I'm reading what teams are doing internally, but I know the quality of thought that's happening in terms of baseball organization. I know how smart the people are, and the idea that it did not occur to them to look at what happens the third time through the order when a pitcher is doing really well and he has a really good track record. Like, of course, that's the first thing you're going to think about when you're analyzing the third time through the order penalty, because if it's a mediocre pitcher, he's not making it to six innings typically anyway. And if it's a good pitcher who is struggling, well, he's probably not going to make it to six innings because he's already going to be out of the game. His pitch count will be up, or they'll have removed him up to that point. So really, your sample size at this point for people who are going to be pitching the third time through the order are good pitchers, typically, who are pitching well. So, I mean, even though you have a pitcher like Walker Buehler who is succeeding and is pitching very well in that moment, or someone like David Price last night, I mean, you know, it might work, it might not work, but the reality is, like, you know, that's already accounted for when we're thinking about doing that, and we're already saying that, well, pitchers do get hit the third time through the order much worse than they do the first two times, because that's exactly the sample we would be looking at in terms of figuring out whether that actually meant anything.
Right. Yeah. No, I think it's a very good point. I think we're at a strange place in baseball right now, in that there is so much information available to us on both the public side and the team side, but there is an information imbalance in terms of what teams have access to and sort of the sophistication of their analysis versus, you know, kind of how we as fans and even analytically inclined fans and writers tend to think about these things. And I don't mean that as a knock on anyone who's doing public side research, because they're really brilliant people, but you have entire departments devoted to this who are, you know, doing really sophisticated analysis and complex modeling, and that's their the entirety of their job. And so I don't say that to excuse teams unnecessarily. Teams still do make mistakes, obviously, but I think that, you know, for thinking fans, for fans who like to think about baseball rather than just watch it, which is fine to do also. This is not a knock on people who are just like enjoying a baseball game. That's a perfectly fine way to enjoy baseball. But I think that it is sort of on us to, in moments where we are confused by a team's decision making, to pause and think about it for maybe a second or two longer, rather than just assume that these decisions are stupid. They may well be stupid. Don't get me wrong, but I think that it's useful for us to think about that additional context, whether it's, you know, how a guy performs the third time through an order or the way that a bullpen is structured and then deployed. You know, there are a lot of smart people thinking about this stuff. And if for no other reason than understanding how they think about it helps us to maybe see places that they are making mistakes and then help to adapt to that thinking, I think, you know, we got to take a pause and a breather and think about it more, which is part of the reason why I actually like the week after the World Series, because we have all of these narratives that we just don't have time in the course of a busy postseason to delve into, and then maybe we get some follow-up afterward. Like, why did Drew Pomeranz not throw any pitches in the World Series? That's so weird. They put him on the roster, didn't throw a single pitch, warmed up in that crazy 18-inning game, but did not pitch. That's really weird. I'd like to know why. Was he hurt? Probably was just a little hurt. But we don't know, so I'd like to hear more about that.
Okay, so I was going to ask you about Drew Pomeranz later. Yes, not much more. But do you, like, if you're Drew Pomeranz and you're thinking about this lifelong dream you've had, you know, you grew up pitching, you dream, man, maybe one day, if I'm lucky enough, I can make it to the major leagues, and then, wow, one day, if I'm so lucky, I could win a World Series, and I could be on the mound in the bottom of the ninth inning, in the final game, and get that last strikeout to win the World Series, and celebrate, and jump around, and drink champagne, and ride in the parade. And then, like, you know, he clearly did not want to be used. He clearly, the Red Sox basically wanted to avoid him unless it was absolutely positively necessary, to the point where they had Nathan Eovaldi throw approximately 8,000 pitches in extra innings, out of relief in game, that was game three, right?
Yeah.
Yes, game three. Correct. I mean, doesn't that have to feel weird that, like, you're going to get all the trappings of having won the World Series, where you were pretty bad during the regular season, you did not pitch during the postseason, you weren't even on the roster for a good chunk of the postseason, then you were around in the World Series, but didn't actually do anything? Like, I'm not taking anything away from him, like, he's obviously a very qualified pitcher, and a very useful player when he is healthy and on his stuff, but, I mean, it has to be this sort of strange internal dichotomy.
Yes. Although my reaction to it illustrates why, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why, but this is one of the reasons why Drew Pomeranz is a professional baseball player and I am not.
Sure.
Because everything you just described to me, a person who is motivated by anxiety and embarrassment, or anxiety about embarrassment, that sounds ideal, man. You were there. You were talking with your guys in the bullpen. You were feeling the feelings. You're like, yeah. Nathan, keep warming up, man. This is great. But you didn't have to risk the embarrassment of giving up a home run in the World Series. That sounds ideal to me. This is why I could not do professional sports. I'd be really bad at it.
Just sneaking your way in.
Yeah, it has to feel funny. Although the thing is that for guys who aren't starting or who have sort of I tend to think we forget these things, right? Like, in a couple of years, I won't remember that Drew Pomeranz was on this World Series roster, but if he had pitched, like, two or three meaningless innings in that 18-inning game, I wouldn't have remembered that, and neither would you, so it's fine. He effectively pitched, for all we'll remember.
Sure. I don't fault him for, like, it's not his fault he didn't pitch. Like, I'm not to say he wouldn't have done a good job if he had pitched.
I mean, maybe. I think that he had to. I think he had to have been dinged up a little bit for them to have, not used him even at all. I mean, last night when they were getting ready to close out that game, I mean, it was clear. It was sort of clear that Sale was going to be the guy on the mound in the end, but they had Evaldi warming up again. He had thrown, as you said, 8,000 pitches, and they had him warming up again. So I think that Pomeranz had to have maybe been a little dinged up. I don't know. It seems strange that he didn't pitch at all. You're right. It's not his fault. It's not his fault. I don't blame him.
No.
And like I have said, like, managers know a lot more about the state of their rosters in any given moment than we ever will. So I assume that there's a reason Cora stayed away from him, but I don't know. It was odd.
It's odd is fair. So in terms of the guys you just mentioned, Chris Sale, of course, is the Red Sox ace. He came in and pitched the ninth inning last night. Nathan Eovaldi is a starter during the regular season, and he was the ace reliever for stretches of this postseason for a Red Sox bullpen that did have major issues. I mean, this was a very 2018 World Series in terms of we saw bullpenning. We saw, you know, guys pitching in relief one night and then starting the next night, which we haven't seen in decades and decades. This was a series dominated by home runs. It was a 3-2 outcome series in a lot of ways. All right, Meg, well, let's get to the way the World Series was played and the way we think baseball is going to be played going forward in a moment. But first, I wanted to talk about Hotel Tonight. We talked about Hotel Tonight a bunch recently on the show, and I cannot recommend highly enough that you use Hotel Tonight if you happen to be leaving your house. Now, granted, if you are in the place where you have a home, I would say, yeah, probably stay there for the night. Otherwise, whether you're going out for a night, whether you're going for a long vacation up to 100 days in advance, you can get a great deal on a great hotel by using Hotel Tonight. Now, I use it myself. I've used it in the past when I've had friends come visit, when I lived in Las Vegas, for example. Now I live in New York. I live in a small apartment. It is very expensive to come to get a hotel here. So I always recommend people check out Hotel Tonight for a cheap deal or a very nice deal on a very expensive luxury hotel. No matter what kind of hotel you want to stay in, Hotel Tonight has options for you in the place where you are heading. And again, if you want to use it for one night, that's fine. You can book it tonight. Hotel Tonight is great at that. But of course, you can now do it up to 100 nights in advance, whether it's a trip with your family, whether it's a business trip coming up. No matter why you're going, as long as you want to save money, you can use Hotel Tonight to get a great deal on the exact type of hotel you want, in the exact location you want, in the city you want, up to 100 days in advance. So I definitely recommend you check it out. Download the Hotel Tonight app. I use it every day on my phone. Or go to HotelTonight.com. Check out the website. Get a great deal on a hotel today. Now back to the show. In terms of the aesthetic feel of this, in terms of how we view baseball in 2018, does this feel more or less appealing to you than any sort of different era of baseball?
So whenever you talk about the aesthetics of the game as they are and how and as they might be, I think, you know, we have to acknowledge that we are used to a particular aesthetic. And so we might have a preference for that aesthetic that is mostly habit. So I will admit that this perspective of mine might change and that I might grow to really like the opener as one aesthetic that we've seen or, you know, the increasingly short few number of innings that starters throw, but I personally really enjoy a good starting pitcher duel. I think that it's, you know, it's really narratively interesting and compelling to watch a guy do this thing that we ask of pitchers, which is completely insane. Like, the fact that anyone pitches is always nuts to me. It's also crazy that anyone catches, because it's so taxing. It's so hard. You are being broken little bit by little bit every single time you do it. Yes. And so to watch a starter, you know, go seven and see what he can do in that seven innings is very compelling to me, which isn't to say that really dominant relief performances can't also be compelling. But this move to like, do sort of pitching by committee is not my preferred baseball aesthetic. I also think that there is a bit of an overreaction to how sustainable and sort of widespread a strategy that strategy is necessarily going to be over a typical 162 game season if you have all 30 teams in baseball trying to do it at once. Because, you know, when we look at the greatest potential weaknesses for any roster, even rosters that are projected to be very, very good, I think the number one thing that we think about is injury, and specifically starting pitcher injury, right? Because there are just, there are a lot of innings. Someone has to throw them. We don't, we don't let guys just not, right? Like, you have to put a pitcher out there. And so the idea that we will be able to find sufficient depth in relief corps and not have that have weird knock-on effects to the rest of rosters and be able to replicate that over 30 teams strikes me as unlikely. I mean, you look at the Rays, who relied on the opener strategy more heavily than any other team in baseball this year. Even they have said, we did this somewhat out of necessity. They had a bunch of guys go down early with Tommy John who weren't able to throw the innings they expected, and so they had to get creative with the resources that they had in-house. And that's a very different thing than the Rays saying our preferred view of baseball and aesthetic for baseball is to have, you know, a bunch of different relievers take a bunch of different innings. And so I don't love it as a widespread phenomena, as a dominant aesthetic of baseball. I also don't think we need to worry too terribly much that it will be that. But I think it's something to keep an eye on, because I think a lot of fans, existing fans of the game, like to have starting, like, pitcher matchups, right? They want to see Chris Sale. They want to see Clayton Kershaw. They want to see James Paxton. You know, just to throw in a guy that I like to watch play baseball. So I think that consideration is an important one. And sometimes I think we, as especially as like analytically inclined writers, dismiss that aesthetic preference a little too readily, because at the end of the day, baseball is an entertainment enterprise. And while we might, you know, I think rightly say, like, well, guys shouldn't bunt so much, like, sacrifice bunts are dumb, there does come a point where that aesthetic consideration for fan engagement is actually a really important question. And you can have an informed aesthetic preference even if you understand the sort of analytics and stats that go into, you know, the Rays needing to use an opener, for example. So I think that we should be careful as analytically inclined writers not to be too dismissive of the aesthetic consideration, even if, you know, there are going to be times when other things have to drive team decision making.
I just find it interesting because, like, at the end of the day, for me, as someone who is a baseball fan first and foremost, and who generally likes watching baseball and has watched it now for, almost 30 years at this point, like, to me, this version of baseball is no more or less aesthetically pleasing than any other version of baseball. No different from watching, you know, teams in the mid-90s, like watching the mid-90s Braves, where you had a bunch of great starting pitchers who pitched a lot of innings and pitched well into, you know, into the seventh and eighth inning and ninth inning, typically in games. I mean, that's not all that different to me than a team having a bullpen game, where, you know, I just don't know. To me, it doesn't seem that much different. And I guess I don't know why any, like, do you think that any aesthetic preference is, like, the ideal when it comes to baseball? Like, should baseball be more like the National League in 1968 than it should be like the American League in 2018? Like, do they have to be one and the other, or should it just be that there's a variety of options should be available and that they should each be equally compelling? I mean, what is it, like, is there one true version of baseball that you think the game should ascend towards?
I don't, actually. Like, I don't think there's a platonic ideal of baseball. And because of that, I get nervous. We've piled on John Smoltz a lot in this postseason, and so I hate to do it a little bit more, but I'm going to do it a little bit more. I think the place where we get into trouble is sort of improperly gauging how reactive we need to be to changes in the game at any given moment. So, you know, Rob Manfred gets a lot of grief for talking about baseball's problems publicly a lot at a time where the league is trying to inspire people to like baseball. Sort of a bummer to hear the commissioner be like, well, baseball's pretty broken sometimes. Like, oh, all right, buddy, I guess I'll stay home today. And, you know, Smoltz has been very public to the point of saying, and you'll have to forgive me, I can't remember where I saw this reported, so sorry to whoever it was of you who did it, but to the point that he's, like, I think going to be petitioning the competition committee to change some of the rules of baseball this offseason to, you know, reduce the shift and do all of these things. And I think that we have to find a balance between accepting that it is the responsibility of the league and Rob Manfred and all of us, I guess, to fret about baseball. Like, it's good to worry about the health of the game, but to not then veer so far into that worry that we are maybe overcorrecting for issues that either will address themselves or will sort of stabilize to the point that it is not a widespread change in the way that the game is conducted. And you have to find a balance between those two things, because sometimes baseball fixes itself. Sometimes you have to raise or lower the mound. And both of those things have been true throughout the history of the game. And worrying about baseball and the health of baseball, I think, is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, because we all really like baseball. We want to watch more of it. We want the game to be healthy and part of our cultural conversation. But it doesn't mean that we always have to intervene every time. And I think about, you know, the league instituted an expanded instant replay in 2014, right? And we failed to anticipate, we being writers, we being the league, we being baseball broadly, we failed to anticipate that when guys come off the bag for a hot second, that managers are going to challenge that every time, because there might be an out hiding between their foot or finger and the base, right? They're going to do that every time because it gives them a strategic advantage. We failed to anticipate that. And in hindsight, like, that's a pretty obvious thing that managers are going to use replay for. And so I think that we should be careful not to make the game course correct too quickly, but also keep a close eye on it to make sure that we aren't missing opportunities or missing necessary interventions. You know, I'm not a parent, but I imagine that's a lot of what parenting is, right? Like, you want your kids to make mistakes so they learn from stuff. You want them to figure things out and find out who they are. But it's really important they not put their finger in an electrical socket. So you got to find the in-between space that allows them to do the growing they need to be vital and engaging and interesting, like we all want people to be, I guess, and also to not electrocute themselves. And that's the balance we need to find for baseball, I think.
To my knowledge, nobody has electrocuted themselves on a baseball field in recent years. I'm not a baseball historian. I can't say for the history of baseball, but it seems like obviously, you know, like, the game is healthy, relatively. Like, I mean, there are a lot of fun young players in the league. This was, in some ways, not the most fun postseason. There were not the sort of, like, series after series crazy games. There were a lot of cool moments. The 18-inning game, I think people are going to remember for a long time, and that was a game that evolved in the way it did, in part because of how it was managed and how it was, how aggressive the managers were, or the different level of aggressiveness the managers had earlier in that game. I mean, do you think the concern here is strictly just velocity and just the way pitchers are pitching and adjustments might have to be made there just because pitchers have become so dominant with velocity and with shorter stints? Or does it extend to shifting, for example, which is a thing that to me seems totally normal and logical and reasonable, but, you know, has come in for some criticism as a way to prevent hitters from hitting the way that they used to?
I'm going to answer this question in two ways. First, specifically around the shift, just because I think it's useful. I mean, there's a fair amount of public side research that actually suggests that teams are not deploying shifts optimally.
Right.
And so I think that we will see shifting change just on its own. We'll see shifting shift. That's terrible. But we will see shifting sort of shift on its own and evolve on its own, because teams are going to get smarter about how and when they deploy shifts, which may result in them shifting a little bit less, although I guess it could result in them shifting more. But I don't think we know what shifting is going to be and will look like even a season or two from now, just because there's more and more research being done on the public side, which means that teams are probably far ahead of that because they have more information and tend to be, and they have more granular Statcast data. So I think shifting will probably either take care of itself or make it very obvious that some intervention is necessary. But I tend to think that these sorts of things are best left alone, because we want teams to try to, like, explore creative and smart strategies. I think more broadly, Joe Sheehan wrote about this for Baseball America, and I think that the CBA negotiation is the wrong place to do this because, you know, CBAs are for a specific thing that right. we shouldn't mess with. But I think that I wonder if we are at a point in the game and sort of these aesthetic debates and strategic debates and debates about what stats are best assessing the game versus not, where some sort of, you know, constitutional convention sounds too formal, but I think that there might be a, if not a need, certainly an opportunity for us to have a broader conversation about what we understand baseball to be. Mm-hmm. And this might be the political theorist in me talking, but it's like, what is our theory of the game right now? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we might say that there isn't a platonic ideal of baseball, but there are certainly some things we like better than others, either because they're more effective in terms of baseball strategy or because they inspire and facilitate a more compelling version of the product we see on the field. Mm-hmm. And I think we're getting to the point where, you know, the sort of big leaps forward we're going to have from a sabermetric perspective are either done, right, and mm-hmm. we're picking at, you know, small marginal improvements, or require access to data that we don't have access to via right. StatCast, which is its own problem that we should probably also talk about. But at this point, I have a tremendous amount of confidence in the computational power needed to, you know, successfully suss out baseball defense, for example, and crediting mm-hmm. for defense. I don't know that we have a good theory of what defense is, though. Like, who should be responsible for what? Who should get credit for what? Mm-hmm. And I think there's an opportunity for further articulation in that space that would be, like, a lot of fun for me. I don't know how fun it would be for anyone else. And the dialogue around it publicly could be so annoying. So we'll allow for that possibility, too. But I think that there is an opportunity for baseball sort of writ large and the different interested parties, let's not call them factions, because I think we all want good baseball at the end of the day, but for, sure. for a bunch of folks to come together and sort of say, like, what is baseball? What do we want it to be? Where is it now? What do we need to think about to get it where it should go? And that conversation, I think, is a worthwhile one, which I imagine we'll spend a lot of the offseason having. We've had versions of it already, but it tends to take the form of, like, stats are good or stats are bad. And I think there's a more nuanced conversation to be had about the actual theory of the game that mm-hmm. we are primed for and maybe should embrace more fully, because now seems like as good a time as any. And if this offseason is anything like last offseason, we probably won't get contracts for a lot of guys until January. So we got to mm-hmm. talk about something in the meantime. And yes. I think it should be this.
Yes. Do you think in 5 years, Major League Baseball will look materially different from the game we saw in 2018?
I think that the answer to that is probably yes, in ways that I can't quite anticipate yet. Mm-hmm. I think that in 5 years we will be at a very, let's see, when does this current version of the CBA expire? I think we'll be in the midst of another, like, really fraught labor conversation in the next mm-hmm. couple of years. And I think that that might end up being, it won't be a completely new change. Baseball has had labor strife before. But I think that after a sort of long period of let's call it detente between the parties, that we are headed toward some pretty profound labor conflict in the next CBA negotiation, and then that, as much as anything, might shape the way that the game ends up looking. But it's hard to anticipate. I mean, like, I didn't anticipate that the you know, that we would have this home run surge. No mm-hmm. one did. That's not a me thing. That's like a we didn't know that the ball was going to be different yes. kind of thing. So I think there's always an opportunity and the potential for the game to shift in a lot of significant ways, or in a lot of really small ways that end up adding up to something much, much bigger. Mm-hmm. But I don't quite know what they'll be. I will either be cowardly enough or smart enough to not put a specific thing on the table. You can decide which.
Yes.
Up to you.
Well, I'm just going to say we can call you, I don't want to call you this, but I think we now have to call you the smart coward, Mick Riley. appearing.
Oh, no, that's a very accurate description of me. Smart, but very pretty.
I don't think that is fair. But Meg, it is a pleasure to have you on. We will definitely talk more baseball during the off season as we hit some, sort of the football lull in February and March. But wanted to have you on to talk about the World Series. Wanted to have you talk about baseball. I didn't gloat that much about the Red Sox. I hope that I was slightly behaved, given that the team I am a fan of has now won 4 World Series in the past, 14 years.
I don't know how you were to say Yankees fans who seem to take a lot of the worst of the snark from Red Sox fans, although they dish out their own snark, so, you know, there are no innocent parties here. But I thought you were very calm. Congratulations on your favorite baseball team winning another World Series. I don't know what that feels like at all, let alone 4 times.
True. You have a football team that has won the Super Bowl and a team that is doing surprisingly well in the Seattle Seahawks, but we will get to them another time here on the show. Meg, please plug where people can check out more of your work.
Well, you can read me at Fangraphs, and you can read work that I edit at the Hardball Times, and I'm always saying something stupid on Twitter, so you can check me out there, too, at Meg Rowler.
All right, Meg, thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, thanks so much to our guests today, Mike Sando of ESPN, Meg Rowley of Fangraphs. We got more football coming later this week, a couple fun guests, a lot more X's and O's stuff coming on Thursday, some hardcore, unfiltered football stuff, as Mike Clay said about our podcast last Thursday, which was a lot of fun. More football coming later this week here on the Bill Barnwell Show.